Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Friday's edition of A Juno Afternoon. I'm your host for today, Andy Klein. And today we got a packed show. We're going to be talking to Wayne Jensen about his Friday fireside lecture at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center and about the history of Alaska's capital. That's going to be tonight at 6:30 and 8 p.m. Then Julie Hench will be here to talk about the details of this Sunday screening of Swan Lake. We'll meet a new teacher at the campus, Emma Davidson. We're going to be talking to lots of people today, including folks who are doing all kinds of stuff all over the place and doing multiple events. That's all happening, plus Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and more. It's all coming up right after National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The $940 million class action lawsuit against the Bureau of Indian Affairs on behalf of tribes cleared its last court hurdle this week. The case stems from decades of claims against the government for not fully paying tribal contract support costs. Lori Townsend has more.
The settlement is similar to one reached with the Indian Health Service last year that also found tribes had agreed to contract amounts for tribal services but were then shorted the funds or in some cases not awarded any money at all for the signed contracts with the federal government. The Rama Navajo tribe started the suit, which eventually became a class action for hundreds of tribes and tribal organizations across the nation. The suit covered BIA tribal contracts from 1994 until 2013. Lloyd Miller is one of the attorneys working the case for tribes. He says a November deadline for tribes to object to the settlement terms passed with no disagreement.
Which was stunning to us because a settlement that involves this kind of money and a lot of tribes, people are experienced with the Cobell case, which was in some corners very controversial, not here. Absolute agreement across Indian country. And these are tribes that stand to gain a lot of money.
Although no tribes objected to the amounts or the terms, Miller says they did hear from tribes that had been missed.
And the databases that the BIA had used to develop the master list was incomplete. So we found another database, and from that database we picked up another 55 tribes and intertribal organizations. So now we have a total of 699 Alaska Native villages, American Indian tribes, and intertribal organizations.
Miller says the incomplete lists were the result of software changes within the BIA over the course of the 20 years the litigation has been ongoing. He says Judge James Parker should issue his final orders in the case within 2 weeks. Payments ranging from tens of millions to tens of thousands will be issued towards spring. For National Native News, I'm Lori Townsend in Anchorage.
Irma Visner, who resigned this week as chairwoman of the White Earth Band of Ojibwe in Minnesota, is talking about her decision, saying she's not finished with tribal politics. Reporter Melissa Townsend has the details.
Visner's resignation comes after months of contentious back and forth with three members of the White Earth Tribal Council over her work to reform the White Earth Constitution. Back in December, at the request of the council, Visner was censured by the Minnesota Chippewa Tribe, that's the band's governing body. That move essentially stripped away her power to represent the band's interests in the larger tribe. She faced a final hearing at White Earth today, but knowing she would likely be removed from office, she chose to resign on Wednesday.
I don't have any options. I fought for constitutional reform for 17 and a half years.
Her adversaries on the White Earth Council say she acted without their consent. Tara Mason is the band's secretary treasurer.
What it comes down to is that she's acting outside her scope of authority.
70-year-old Irma Visner says she's going to take some time off, and then in 2 years, she's going to run for Mason's job as secretary-treasurer. Irma Visner has served in the White Earth Tribal Government since 1996. In 2004, she was elected as the first chairwoman of the band. For National Native News, I'm Melissa Townsend.
Some public schools in Oregon can keep their Indian mascot if they get permission from a tribe in the state. This after the State Board of Education approved an amendment Thursday to relax the rule, which had banned them. The state's Indian Education Association supports a ban, and Native groups and national organizations are working to fully abolish Indian mascots from schools and professional sports teams across the country. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Kewaunee Broadcast Corporation is accepting artwork and reservations for the Alaska Native Art Auction February 18, 2016 in Anchorage, Alaska. Over 400 business leaders and executives attend this annual event. Proceeds benefit Kewaunee's news program. Learn more at knba.org. Support by the National Indian Health Board. Open enrollment for the health insurance marketplace ends January 31st. Many Indian health clinics are hosting enrollment events with help available. You may qualify for low-cost plans, zero copays, and deductibles. More info at healthcare.gov/tribal.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
And welcome back to a Juno Afternoon. Andy Klein with you, and Wayne Jensen has joined me in the studio. Wayne, thanks so much for coming in.
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity.
Wayne, you've got a busy night ahead of you. You've got two different lectures happening as part of the Friday Fireside Lecture Series out at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center. Tell me a little bit about what you're going to be talking about.
Well, we're talking about the history of the Alaska Capitol, and that's capital spelled with an O, which means the building, as opposed to A. Although the capital city and the capital building are pretty intricately intertwined, but this presentation is on the building, and it starts with a lot of historic photographs and information regarding the original planning of the building and the design and construction of the building, and then, you know, the building's life as the territorial and federal and territorial building, and then the transition to the Alaska State Capitol.
So when was it first built?
The construction started in 1929, and it was dedicated in 1931.
And
the first session, the first territorial legislature that met there was in the winter of 1931.
So the history of Alaska is tied to that building since 1931.
Actually, it is with that building, yes. But the planning for that building actually started in 1900, and it took them 30 years to get the building with a lot of stops and starts. But they finally got the building dedicated in 1931, and of course it served as the federal and territorial building, you know, up until statehood. And at the beginning, three-fourths of the building, if not more, was federal offices. And there was just a few that were territorial offices. We had the territorial governor and the territorial legislature and the territorial museum and library, which took up a very small portion of the building. It took up maybe a third of one floor.
So has the building always had the general appearance that we're familiar with today?
Pretty close. There hasn't been a lot of change. It was it's an Art Deco style, which is a very conservative Art Deco style. You know, it's not like the Chrysler Building in New York, but it's
indicates that style in that building? I wouldn't think that on that building.
Yeah, there's some of the decoration. The decoration, either inside and outside the building, uses some bright colors and some geometric patterns, and that's primarily what designates it as that style. But it's a very conservative application of that style. It's a typical, federal government agency approach. It's a very, it's a competent building in that style. And some of those things you don't notice. You get used to it. You see it as a brick building, and but you get close. And there's some very intricate detailing around the windows that is made out of terracotta. There's some very nice places in the building, inside the building, that have very geometric patterns, even on the handrails and, different places in the building. So, it's subtle, but it's evident.
Was there it's an interesting time to be thinking about taking on a big construction project. Obviously, the Depression was just beginning. Right. The crash had already happened in 29. So did that affect the building of it?
Well, the one good thing is there might have been a lot of labor available.
Yeah.
And it was a heavily, heavy labor building. It was the general contractor was from Chicago. Which was kind of interesting. Of course, it was advertised for bid by the U.S. Treasury Department, who were the designers for the building, so it would have been advertised out of Washington, D.C., and would have been contractors from all over the United States, and I imagine they were very hungry in 1929. But as a contractor from Chicago, and doing a little research on that contractor, they had done two remodelings of the White House. So they were
That
same contractor. So they were very well known to that agency, and did a good job. They started work in the fall of 1929, and it was finished and dedicated in February of 1931. So like 18 months from start to finish on
site. It's a big building.
That's a big building. Yeah. It's 90,000 square feet, and I doubt if that could be done today.
So, yeah.
They did a really good job. Worked through the winter, and did a good job.
When it was built, did it receive notoriety as being a stylistic representation? Was it a building that was talked about at all, or was it just sort of like, not talked about too much?
Well,
a little bit out of the way of the mainstream media.
Sure.
And stuff.
Probably made in any newspapers other than the Juneau newspaper.
Right.
But in looking at it, I use the term, it's a very competent, very solid design building. Conservative, it's certainly not elaborate in any way, and it's very functional.
Like many government buildings.
Yeah,
but it does separate out from other state capitol buildings, though, doesn't it? I mean, it doesn't have the grandiose atrium and those kinds of things.
It does, and I think as much as anything, it was primarily a federal office building. It was the post office. I mean, it was the post office, and it was the federal judiciary. The courtrooms were there, and the law department, the federal marshal, the Fish and Wildlife Service, the Bureau of Public Roads, Forest Service, mm-hmm. they were all in that building. So it was a federal building, and probably wouldn't be too much different than federal buildings, elsewhere in the United States.
And did it replace a building that was existing as far as the offices moving over into the new Capitol building?
I think at that point, I don't know if it replaced buildings or whether they were renting space. I'm really not sure about that. But
I know that there was an old federal building they always talk about on the site of where the state office building is
mm-hmm,
today.
Mm-hmm. I think that was the court building and the jail. Now, I don't know whether that was a federal or a territorial building.
Right.
I think it was a jail and a courthouse there.
Mm. Does the Capitol building hold any secrets? Does it have interesting little places that people might not know about? I've worked in there before and know of some places. I've been down in the bomb shelter
quite
a bit and worked in the video office that's been built down there. I don't know if it's still there.
It's
it was
still
20
there.
Years
it's
ago.
Still there.
Yeah.
That wasn't part of the original building. That was an unexcavated place, and that was built in the 60s or 70s, I think. There's a crawl space under the building, which most people don't realize. Under the, along 4th Street and a little ways up Seward Street, there's a crawl space under there, which is not a very pleasant place.
Just
but
dirt, kind of?
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah, pretty much. One of the things that I don't think
just
people...
Just because it's built into a hill. And
yeah,
so
it's built
just
into
to,
a hill.
To have the first floor be level, it's just
yeah,
there's a,
right.
there's
so
a vacant space,
space yeah.
under it, yeah.
And I think... one of the things people don't realize is you look at the building and you think it's a masonry building. It's a brick building. It's really a concrete building, and the brick is more of a veneer. So the brick is non-bearing, but it's a concrete building. It's pretty well done.
It wasn't a new material then, but concrete was a material. The concrete and steel construction was this construction that allowed for these skyscrapers to start happening.
Right.
I would think that at the time that was this scene.
I won't say it was cutting edge, but it was current technology, and it was pretty well done. We were fortunate to have the original drawings of the building. There's about 70 or 80 sheets in the original drawing set. Their artwork in themselves, some of them, they're ink on linen, and they're beautiful drawings.
Really?
And some of them are just gorgeous drawings. It's interesting that even though it was a federal project, the state ended up with the original drawings. So they're in the archives. They sat for years in DOT, in a file cabinet at DOT. And when we started this project, I knew they were somewhere around here. And so we found them and made good digital copies of them we used during construction. And then we were able to get the originals into the archives for a little more secure than just sitting around in somebody's file cabinet.
Now, this is what we've been talking about so far is kind of the history, the original building of it. Of course, it's maybe gone through, has it gone through a few facelifts through the years?
Not on the exterior. The exterior is pretty much the same. There have been some new windows put in, but the exterior is pretty much the same. One of the main things that was changed over the years was there was a very distinctive cornice at the roof, which stuck out from the building about 3 feet, and it was very decorative, and that was one of the best examples of the Art Deco style. It was very geometric, and that was taken off in the 60s, probably because it was deteriorating and was danger of maybe falling off, so it was taken off. And so what we see is a very plain top of the building, very flat.
Yeah.
Just a
cinder block kind of sitting
exactly,
there, sort of,
actually.
Yeah.
And so, but now the west side, the Main Street side, is finished, and that new cornice has been installed. So that's going to be a very significant change to the building, and it's going to return it to its 1931 appearance.
Oh, great.
So when we get done, the idea is it'll look like it did in 1931.
Yeah, so as you said, when you started this project, so you're not just a historian about this, you're also an architect, and you're working on your firm is working on the
right.
actual restoration of the project.
Right.
So tell me a little bit about undertaking a historic building like this that obviously has great importance to
yeah.
the community and to the state that you're working in, idea of getting back to the original.
There were several investigations of the building just to determine, you know, what condition it was in and, you know, whether it was worth saving, whether it could be restored as it is or whether it was some of it would have to be replaced, and determined that the building itself, the structure, is in really good shape. We had good drawings, and they all seemed to pan out pretty well. So the thing that was a problem or a concern was, you know, in 1929, they didn't understand the seismic forces that we do today. I mean, the codes have changed drastically mm-hmm. from that area. Just by interest, the building code from the city in the 1920s is about half an inch thick. Now it consists of several volumes, all of which are 2 or 3 inches thick. I mean, it's a whole bookshelf full of codes.
Right.
So it's a totally different situation. But the seismic, so the real purposes of the new renovation was, one is to reinforce it seismically, and then second was to replace or restore the exterior envelope, which consists of the brick and the windows and the terracotta and the stone. And then the third was, since we were working on the exterior walls, was to replace the heating system, the heating units, because the heating units were all old, 80-year-old
mm-hmm.
with black iron pipes and you know, were past their useful life. And so those three things, but all dealing with primarily the exterior walls of the building. And that's what's coming along. We're
yeah.
doing concrete shear walls for the seismic and then replacing the brick. A typical brick wall is about 18 inches thick up there, those brick, because they're like three layers of brick and then one layer of what we call hollow clay tile and then plaster. So there's four layers of masonry in a typical wall. We're replacing that with one layer of brick, insulation, this concrete shear wall, another layer of insulation, and sheetrock. And so we're using the same size of the wall, but it's insulated and it's structurally reinforced, and it, you know, still has the same exterior appearance.
Mm. Wow, that's really fascinating. So
it'll be really it'll be energy efficient.
Yeah,
and seismically reinforced.
And the scheduled for completion when?
About this time next year. So,
okay.
The schedule calls for dedication to be about this time. I would expect, you know, one of the first things the legislative session might do is have a dedication
ceremony.
Well,
there you go.
So,
yeah, that'd be great. That'd be
yeah.
a great way to open
yeah.
the 2017 session.
Yeah, it would.
Well, Wayne, thanks so much. It's Wayne Jensen, and you are doing a fireside lecture out at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center. That's going to be tonight at both 6:30 and then again at 8 o'clock. Admission is free. So go check out what Wayne is talking about. And then, of course, can't see it on radio, but your presentation is all about historical photos and building that picture of what that building's been through the years and also the renovation.
We're very fortunate that most of the photos that were taken in that area were done professionally. So they're not Kodak snapshots. They're very good quality photos, and they really show up well on a PowerPoint.
All right. Well, Dwayne Jensen, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
And have a great time talking about the state capitol tonight, both at 6:30 and 8 o'clock out at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center.
Thanks. I'll be over at 10, it's only time and again.
was so late. I went around and then I run to the store. I can't take anymore without you. You let me down again.
Building up that Capitol building. Thanks to Wayne Jensen for coming in. Next with me is Julie Diana. Julie, thanks so much. Julie's with the Juno Dance Theater, and you've got a really cool event coming up where you're partnering up with the Gold Belt Nickelodeon or Gold Town Nickelodeon Theater with Colette there, and going to be showing Swan Lake, but a very special edition of Swan Lake.
It is. Well, first, thank you for having me on this program. It's a very special screening of Swan Lake. It's a never-before-seen, high-definition restoration of a historic Rudolf Nureyev and Margot Fonteyn performance of Swan Lake. It's all of Nureyev's choreography, and you know, many people haven't had the opportunity to see them dance live.
We were saying that, like, you know, when I grew up, I can remember... Well, so this is a performance in 1963. So, and I'm, you know, so I'm old, and that's right before I was born. Uh-huh. So, but I remember growing up, my parents had a book on the shelf that said it was called Nureyev, and it was his, I think, autobiography, maybe. Yeah, right. Talking about not just dance, but also defecting and all this other really interesting stuff, right? But so it was a name I knew.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and of course, it's like the name that's talked about as the greatest, who are the greatest dancers ever, Nureyev, you know, the way people talk about Pavarotti or people talk about.
Well, he revolutionized, and, you know, 19th century classical ballet. He
in
helped
what
reform
way?
It. He took a lot of the movements and started making them off balance. Classical ballet, you want to be very upright. And he was already starting to use partners' weight distribution to pull each other off a little bit and to do things that were more contemporary looking. So when you look at choreographers today like Christopher Wheeldon, Alexei Rotmansky, people who are very popular in the current ballet world, you see where they got a lot of their inspiration.
Now
taking
what,
a look at this 1963 footage.
What's happening? What was he trying to achieve by doing that? The off balance by doing those things. Does it create a higher level of excitement?
Drama, exactly. Nureyev was all about drama and excitement. He was very animalistic, almost in his approach to dancing, and you see that very vividly in his choreography through his acting. He was actually not against pantomime, traditional ballet pantomime, but he didn't want to bog the flow of the production down with too much of it. He really believed in minimizing the pantomime and using more the steps to tell the story versus gestures.
So if we were to see a ballet that was done maybe before Nureyev's time, we might not recognize it as the way that we think of ballet today?
It would be different. We still do a lot of classical productions today that are very popular, but he was one of the first to, he choreographed more solos for the men in these productions, when typically it's all about the ballerina, and the man is just standing behind us.
The man's the
frame.
Figure
just to support.
Right, the woman's
and,
the painting.
And he created, he gave, you know, a lot of these characters much more complex emotion and passion and interest and a lot more choreography within the production to help tell the story. So
was he unusual in that he was the lead dancer and also choreographer, or was that a typical thing? Or
at the time, there were a lot of dancers who were always also choreographers as well. He was a very special case, though. I mean, he was in demand all over the world, and when he and Fonteyn finally paired up, he was only 23 and she was 42.
About Fonteyn then. That's maybe, Nureyev is a name I've heard. Fonteyn, I guess I've maybe heard it, but
she
tell me.
She was a very, very famous dancer with the Royal Ballet in London. and very much known for her artistry, not so much a bravura dancer with tremendous technique. She never really got her leg above 45 degrees, but it didn't matter. It was just exquisite.
Right.
And when you had her kind of sublime artistry next to, paired with Nureyev's kind of powerful animalistic approach, it created something very wonderful. And people were so eager to see them dance that their agent charged far more for them as a pair than the sum of their individual fees. So they were just really, really in demand. And
you can imagine that. It seemed, mm-hmm. I'm sure it would seem like a almost a once in a lifetime thing. Was this? Mm-hmm. Am I right in assuming this is sort of the tail end of her career?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, she did dance for quite a while, I believe, into her 50s.
Okay.
Yeah, she did dance for quite a while.
But, I mean, that is fairly advanced. I mean, ballet is so athletic that sort of the peak, I would think it's...
I retired well before that.
I would think that.
Absolutely. But you see, you know, you watch this screening that we're going to be showing tomorrow, Sunday at 4:30 p.m. at the Gold Town, and also on Monday at 7 p.m., and you don't see her age. She just transcends, and it's really pretty remarkable and inspiring. It's really inspiring.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that she was making adjustments, or was her dance style such that she didn't really have to make adjustments? She always just stayed just very artistic and...
I believe that she probably did subtly, not so much that we would notice. I mean, that's one of the beautiful things about our art form as well, that it is an art of disguise in a way, that you show your strengths and you kind of minimize your weaknesses, and you find ways within the classical discipline to do that. And she just did it with such tremendous grace.
And at this time, 1963, was Nureyev still a Soviet citizen? Was he, or had he defected, or what?
He had defected, and they had just started their partnership through various gala performances in Europe. And they finally paired up. I think their first production together was Giselle. And then they did the Swan Lake at the Vienna State Opera Ballet, and he choreographed the entire thing. That was his first full version of it.
Mm-hmm.
They had danced together before in other people's versions, but this was really something that he created.
Right. And so this was one that was filmed in 1963 at the Champs-Élysées Theater in Paris. And so is there a bit of a history about this print, about this movie that you're aware of, or is this just it's available for the first time in this digital format?
Correct.
Right?
Yes, it has been available on DVD, but there's nothing like seeing it on the big screen. And
right.
It is the closest we'll get to seeing them, you know, live. So I think it's going to be pretty remarkable. I really look forward to seeing it.
Cool. And it's happening Sunday, January 24th at 4:30, and then again Monday on the 25th at 7 p.m.
7 p.m.
And
yep, and we have tickets available at junodance.org, jhc.org, at Hearthside Books, and at the door. General admission is $12 and $10 for youth. And then Juno Dance Theater members get a discounted rate of $10 and $8 for under 18.
So there's something that you could tell people to sort of like watch for of either Nureyev or Fontaine, something that the signature thing or... you know, that dancers would say, oh, that's so Fontaine, or that's so Nureyev, or something. Are there things?
Absolutely. All the details. And especially in Fontaine's use of her port-a-bra and her the way she uses her arms and her head and all of the transition steps. You know, it's one thing to do an arabesque, one thing to do a pirouette, but how did she get into that? And what are the steps that connected all of them? And she was just really a master. And Nureyev, just, you know, his passion. And his... The choreography he gave himself was really, really difficult. He did not water it down, and that was a great testament to him wanting to constantly push the limits and push the audience
as well. Well, such a cool event to have happening. Anything else going on that we should know about
at
the Juno Dance Theater?
Yes, we have a huge event coming up called Juno's Got Talent, and we have auditions for this talent show on February 6th. At 3:30 p.m., and it's going to be at the JDT studio. We are calling for all talents. We're looking for singers, jugglers, musicians, actors, dancers, any kind of performance artist to come audition for this event. And the finalists will perform at the Jack on March 12th for a panel of judges and the audience.
Wow.
To determine the winner.
Real honest-to-goodness talent show.
It is, yeah.
With auditions and judges and everything.
Absolutely. And there's no Simon Cowell present, though. It's going to be very
not
positive.
Not mean-spirited.
No,
yes.
Positive, family-friendly. Right. And we want everyone to have
where's
fun.
Where's the drama? Come on.
There's going to be some fun, you know, prizes along the way.
Cool.
No host bar for the event. But we're really looking for people to come out on February 6th. And if they can't make it, they can register online at junodance.org and submit a video as well if they can't make it to the live audition. But we encourage people to go to our site and audition.
And then the performance of it's happening on the 12th, is that right?
On March 12th.
Which is going to be really fun. So, again, it's February 6th from 3:30 to 5:30, the auditions for Juno's Got Talent. And that's happening at the Juno Dance Theater, which is at 8420 Airport Boulevard. And then this weekend, though, is a really fun, cool thing of Swan Lake. Amazing. Fontaine and Nureyev, as you were saying, the closest we'll ever get to seeing them perform Swan Lake together. This was a performance filmed in 1963 in Paris, and it's been remastered. It's a digital print that's been remastered. So that's Sunday at 4:30 and then Monday at 7 p.m. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you,
Julie,
for having me. I appreciate it.
Julie Diana from Juno Dance Theater. Thanks so much.
And thank you.
Have a wonderful time at Swan Lake.
I will.
Now here's Garrison Keillor with Writer's Almanac.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 22nd of January, 2016. Thornton Wilder's play, Our Town, got its first performance on this day, 1938, the McCarter Theater, Princeton, New Jersey. He had trouble writing the last act, and finally got his inspiration when he was in Zurich, Switzerland. He stayed up all night so he could hear the bells in the morning. There was heavy rain. He walked around town under an umbrella. And it gave him an idea for the graveyard scene in Grover's Corners with the people sitting under umbrellas. The play was unusual for its time because Wilder decided not to use scenery and almost no props. From Princeton, the play went to Boston, where the Boston critics gave it very poor reviews. Some audience members walked out, but in New York, two critics, Brooks Atkinson and Alexander Wolcott, loved the play, and it won the Pulitzer Prize for Drama in 1938, and it is now estimated that on average, Our Town is performed at least once every night somewhere in the world. It's the birthday of Howard Moss, born in Queens, New York, 1922, poetry editor for many years for the New Yorker magazine, who accepted early poems by Sylvia Plath, Theodore Rethke, Anne Sexton, W.S. Merwin. Howard Moss, who did not hesitate to ask poets for revisions. He said, "The words in poems are no more sacred than words in anything else." And it's the birthday of Lord Byron, the poet, born London, 1788. His first poems published when he was 19, went off traveling through France and Italy, worked hard to gain a reputation as a romantic and a playboy and a gambler, a man who had love affairs with one person after another. Lord Byron, who said, "Passion is the poetry of life. What should I have known or written had I been a quiet mercantile politician or a lord in waiting? A man must travel and turmoil, or there is no existence." Here's a poem by Lord Byron on his birthday, his poem, "She Walks in Beauty." She walks in beauty like the night of cloudless climes and starry skies, and all that's best of dark and bright meet in her aspect and her eyes, thus mellowed to that tender light which heaven to gaudy day denies. One shade the more, one ray the less, had half impaired the nameless grace which waves in every raven tress or softly lightens o'er her face. where thoughts serenely sweet express how pure, how dear their dwelling place. And on that cheek and o'er that brow, so soft, so calm, yet eloquent, the smiles that win, the tints that glow, but tell of days in goodness spent, a mind at peace with all below, a heart whose love is innocent. She Walks in Beauty, a poem by Lord Byron. That's the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetrymagazine.org. And by Lumosity.com, brain training developed by scientists to challenge memory and problem solving through online games. Lumosity.com. And by LegalZoom, providing legal help to Americans with online services, customer support, and independent legal advice. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Jack is delighted to present Capital Steps, a D.C.-based comedy troupe in their 17th season of bipartisan lampooning and satirical performances. The Capital Steps provide a unique blend of musical and political comedy and will present their show to Juno based on songs from their current album, Mock the Vote. No one is safe. Barack Obama sings show tunes. Chris Christie doing classical ballet. Don't miss this one. The Capital Steps at Centennial Hall on Sunday, January 24th, 7 p.m. Tickets available at the Jack, Hearthside Books, and JAHC.org. And welcome back to a Juno Afternoon. Brandon Howard and Mercedes Munoz have joined me in the studio, both from the Canvas. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks for having us, Andy.
We were just talking. There's so much going on at the Canvas right now. So let's start with you, Mercedes. You are the studio manager there at the Canvas. But do you have a, and you also are doing a show coming up.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about that.
I have a show coming up at the Canvas, first Friday in February, the 5th. Good continuation. I have about 150 porcelain pieces, and I'm really looking forward to putting that up in the gallery. It'll
so
be really
can you
cool.
tell me about like what maybe people will see, a sneak preview of...
Well, my last show I had at Annie Kale's last April, I had about 40 tumblers, and this time I have 100 tumblers, among other things. So tumblers are the main thing I have.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
And do you kind of go through all different types of forms of those tumblers, or...
Yeah, they're all different sizes.
Okay.
So they range from smaller to really large, almost like vase size. And I have a lot of surface decoration on them, some Mishima, which is a inlay of underglaze. So they get really fine details on them. And then a lot of gold and light translucent colors. So
what's the process of making that, from start to finish, to make one tumbler with something that's kind of complicated on it?
The most complicated technique would be the Mishima, where I'm laying a wax on the greenware and carving into it. And then once it's dried, I put pigment in those lines and wipe it away. And everywhere that I've etched leaves that dark color. So then when it's fired, I get really fine lines.
And then does the tumbler of the porcelain, does that come to you as a whole piece already, or you're making that from the ground up,
yeah.
Or how does it? Yeah, that's,
yeah
tell me about that stuff. So that's what I wanted. When I hear pottery, I think, okay, you're making it from the ground up. But sometimes porcelain, there's stuff where people are painting it,
okay.
But it's already formed or something. So I'm being dumb here. But
no, you're fine.
Tell me what.
Everything I make is on the wheel.
Okay.
Yeah, so
okay.
I make everything myself, thrown on the wheel.
What differentiates porcelain from, say, it's just a different material?
It's a different clay body. I've worked with stoneware, too. I prefer porcelain because when it's fired, it's a really beautiful white. And so that's a nice, clean slate to have when you're drawing.
Yeah. It's sort of fine edges and those kinds of things seem to be achieved in porcelain from my obviously not high level of knowledge.
Yeah, okay. It's just a nice, clean slate to have. I really like the color.
Well, cool. So is there any direction you're moving in right now that you kind of feel like, oh, this is one of the things I'm really experimenting with, either color or form or that kind of thing?
I'd say the drawing technique. It's a new technique that I'm trying with carving into the clay, and it's been really successful for what I'm trying to achieve, and I've been having a lot of fun doing that.
That must be a great feeling, right?
Yeah.
That you kind of like, I'm going to try this thing, and like, whoa, that looks great.
Yeah, I'm really enjoying
it. That's cool.
Yeah.
Well, Brandon, you're the you're the artistic coordinator there at the Canvas, so tell me other stuff that's happening there.
Yeah, so aside from Mercedes' exhibit, which I'm just thrilled about, her plans for the layout, I'm going to talk a little bit more about Mercedes real quick, if you don't mind. But
she's embarrassed.
Her plans for the layout are incredible. You know, 100 of these tumblers, and if you don't know what a tumbler is, it's basically just a tall, narrow cup. 100 of them is quite the undertaking, especially when you see the surface treatment that she's put on them. I mean, each one of these is a large amount of Mercedes' time, and they're all gorgeous. I love my job because I get a sneak peek at what artists are doing, and the idea that she has for the display and the work that she's been pulling out of the kilns is just incredible. And you know, she was talking about the porcelain, and I love working with porcelain too, but watching Mercedes work with it is very, very impressive. And she gets things that are so thin and light that the porcelain clay body is actually translucent and light shines through it.
Oh, that's fine china, like that sort of a look. Yeah, right.
Yeah, exactly. I've got a couple of her pieces at home, and I have them up in the windowsill. And when the sun's out, which is a rarity around here, but they they just light up, and they're really beautiful.
Cool.
So another thing that we have coming up. She's been pulling double duty right after her exhibit on Saturday, February 6th. We have a fundraising dinner. You can check it out online at canvasarts.org. And tickets are $60. And with your ticket, aside from helping out a great community art studio, you also get a handmade plate from Mercedes. She cranked out about 85,
is that right?
Yeah.
85 plates while preparing for your own show?
Yeah.
Yeah. So
that happened.
She's been spending a little bit of time in the studio. And then some of the artwork from one of the artists we work with at the Canvas, we put their work onto the plate, so it's kind of a collaborative piece.
Cool.
And they're also very beautiful.
When you're doing that many pieces, is it hard to stay excited about each individual piece? You know what I mean? It seems like it might be repetitive.
I really enjoy making plates. It's a really fun process. I will say I was physically exhausted. 1 week I threw about 500 pounds of clay, but besides that, I enjoy throwing plates. It's a fun form to make.
Because it's just sort of a kind of an easy canvas in a way, or it's just a flat space, or like a lot of space to decorate, or
well, like Brandon said, we're using an image by one of our artists, Joanne Sam, and it's a beautiful image that takes up the whole center of the plate.
Oh, I see. So they're all that image. Oh, okay.
Exactly. Yeah. So we have a transfer process where we can take her drawing and put it on the plate. So I'm just making the plate, the canvas for her, and then her image is right in the center of the plate.
I see. But each canvas, as you say, is this handmade.
Yeah.
Beautiful porcelain plate.
Yeah.
Amazing.
And
yeah.
Each one's a little bit different. And I think a lot of people don't realize, for one, how much form there really is in a plate. You know, I when teaching classes and teaching people to make plates, they want to just put a piece of clay on the wheel and flatten it out. And they're like, there we go, that's a plate.
It's like, well, all the peas will run off the side if you do that.
Exactly. And, so when you really get to looking at plates, there's a lot to them. The other thing people don't realize is that it takes about 5 to 6 pounds of clay to throw a decent plate, and that is a lot.
Why is that?
Oh, because you end up...
You're taking away. Is that what's happening?
Yeah, you have to go back and trim away the extra, but you need that support on the sides when you're pulling up the walls. And underneath, there has to be a lot of clay when you're throwing, otherwise it'll crack. So it takes a lot of clay, but then you trim a lot off of it.
Right. Wow, but still, yeah, you're really, it's a real process of like excavation almost to get down to where that plate is what's left.
Right. Yeah, it's big piece of clay to get there.
Big chunk of clay.
It's pretty impressive. I mean, like she said, 500 pounds of clay in a week.
Yeah.
That's, you know, 10 50-pound boxes that she has to haul around and wedge each 5-pound ball of clay.
Is it fired in a kiln? Is that what it's fired? So much can your kiln take at any one time? Is it pretty big? Or?
It has to go through 3 firings. So the first one, I can fit them all in one kiln because I can stack them. After that, I can fit about 25 in each kiln.
Okay.
So it's taking me about 4 of that firing, the glaze firing.
A real process.
Yeah.
Look, kind of intimidating, right? You need me to do what?
Yeah.
How many plates again?
All while preparing to fill an entire gallery exhibit. And so it's like I said, it's been amazing watching her work. And I also have to say, at the same time, she's been teaching classes. We have a lot of homeschool classes going, after school classes for students. Going and an evening class for the community going, aside from the classes that she teaches at the campus. So it's a lot on one person's plate. So that has been a really, really cool thing to watch at the campus. The other exciting thing that we have coming up, aside from the fundraising dinner, is so last year we brought 2 visiting artists up for the year, Tim Ortiz, Andreana Donahue. They were amazing to work with and did great things in the studio. And so we're continuing this program. And we've got another artist who's going to be joining us. She gets here next week. Her name is Emma Davidson. And she's a new graduate from SCAD, the Savannah College of Art and Design, down in Georgia.
I was just through Savannah last year. It's one of the coolest art towns, right? I had no idea.
Yeah.
But you know how they have this incredible design school there, and they've bought all these different buildings throughout the city. So it's not like one campus concentrated, but everywhere it's all owned by SCAD.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
It's really cool. Yeah,
I
love
Savannah.
There's a lot of hip people walking around, you know. Yeah,
yeah. I actually lived in Savannah for like 6 years.
Really? Okay.
So I'm super excited for her to get here, share her expertise. She's going to be teaching a lot of really cool classes. She does a lot of fiber arts. She is going to be doing a needlepoint felting landscape class. And when she first told me about it, I was like, I don't know what needlepoint felting is really. And then she started sharing with me things that artists are doing with needlepoint felting. And it kind of blew my mind.
Yeah,
cool. So we're also going to be doing she's going to be doing a lot of kids' classes. We have some great things coming up over spring break. And all of the classes that she's going to be teaching, she has so many really fascinating processes. She's going to be teaching a solar etching class where you use light to create the etching for your print.
I don't know. I guess that'll work. It doesn't.
Yeah, she's all these mediums that
I remember drawing
I've never
stuff
heard
with
of.
A magnifying glass, you know, when I was a kid. You know, maybe it's something like that. I don't know.
Yeah, it's a really cool process. I've been researching it because I have to get the materials for it and have some general idea of it. She has a lot of really, really cool things that she's going to be teaching.
So a lot going on at the Canvas. First Friday coming up with your showing. That's on the 5th. And then on the 6th, the dinner that's happening. What's the name of the dinner again?
It's just the Canvas Fundraising Dinner.
Canvas Fundraising Dinner. Yep. Why get complicated?
Right.
And that's and tickets there for is canvasarts.org?
Canvasarts.org. You can get them online or you can stop in and get them in person.
Great. Well, Brandon and Mercedes from the campus, thanks so much for coming in. Really appreciate it. Good luck with First Friday and with the fundraising dinner.
Yeah, thank you, Andy.
Okay.
Thank you. Bring
For most birds, keen eyesight is absolutely critical for finding food, spotting predators, and generally staying alive. But many birds lead lives that could be very hard on the eyes, like flying at breakneck speed, racing for cover into a dense thicket, or diving underwater to catch a spiny, struggling fish. Fortunately, birds have evolved a structure for protecting their eyes. Like humans, they have upper and lower outer eyelids. But beneath the outer eyelids lies an extra eyelid called the nictitating membrane. Nictitating, for all its alliterative syllables, simply means blinking. This extra eyelid is hinged on the inner side of the eye and sweeps horizontally across the cornea. The nictitating membrane is largely transparent, and it helps keep the eye moist and clean while guarding it from wind, dust, and hazards. Birds aren't the only animals gifted with nature's goggles. Reptiles and some mammals have the extra eyelid too. A polar bear's nictitating membrane helps protect its eyes against the intense glare of Arctic light, preventing snow blindness. Nature's goggles become nature's sunglasses. For BirdNote, I'm Mary McCann.
Support for this station comes from the Treadwell Ice Arena, located at 105 Savico Road in Douglas. Treadwell Ice Arena is open 7 days a week, offering drop-in open skating, hockey, and a variety of special events. We are the proud home of the Crimson Bears hockey team, youth, adult, hockey, and figure skating programs. More information at juno.org/parksrec/icerink or call 586-0410.
And welcome back to Juno Afternoon. Andy Klein with you, and Justin Showman has just joined me to talk about KTOO's upcoming Seafood Fest. Justin, I'm just going to mention a couple other things. There's so much going on here.
It's a busy weekend.
I think that people kind of, I mean, the holidays think like, oh, the holidays are over, okay, everything's going to be. No, it keeps going, man. It keeps going, weekend after weekend, time after time.
I think I get tricked every year. I always think January is going to be this down month, and it never,
right.
ever is.
So as we already talked to Wayne Jensen, he's doing the Fireside Lecture out at the Mendenhall Visitor Center tonight. That's at 6:30 and 8 p.m. Sound in Motion is happening tonight at the Egan Lecture Hall, so that's going to be awesome. The out of the brewery, I'm going to be helping with something, Big Beer and Barley Wine Tasting at the brewery from 5 to 7 tonight. So come out and have some delicious big beers. And, Justin, what's happening to Seafood Fest? That's happening on February 6th, right?
That is. So just 2 weeks away now, or 2 weeks and a day.
You guys kind of blew it up this year.
We did.
You know, it kind of got big all of a sudden, right? It's going to be wild.
It's going to be a really good time. You know,
yeah.
And this event, it was such a great, it was predates me, but such a great story of its humble roots at the Yacht Club. And the staff here at KTOO really pulling together, rolling up their sleeves and preparing all the seafood and the whole dinner themselves. And it's grown up over the years. Last year it was at the Jack. The last couple of years, we started to involve local restaurants and work with partners in town. And now this year, after we were at maximum capacity and then some last year at the Jack, so we have moved it to Centennial Hall.
The big time.
The big time.
The Carnegie, the biggest place. Practice. That's how you get there.
So, yeah, this thing is all grown up, so to speak, at this point.
And as you were saying, like, I was a part of the humble beginning, not beginnings, but I remember part of it was that, you know, it used to be the halibut feed, mm-hmm. and that was because this is before the time of IFQs, so there was a halibut opening, and all of a sudden there was a glut of halibut on the market, and we'd have a big halibut feed. And then it turned into a seafood fest, and Taku and other people have been so generous about giving the seafood. Is that who's still donating the seafood?
It is,
yeah.
Yeah, and I would really like to thank them personally. Taku Fisheries donating again this year. And one of the things that they have done is significantly increase that donation this year from what it's been in the past, and it's really allowing us this year to put the focus solely on that seafood.
And that's what's so cool. So then what we did was that, okay, well, we got salmon in, so we would grill the salmon and all that. Then Cheryl had that awesome idea a couple of years ago and started developing this idea. Well, what about if we took that ingredient and then let all these amazing, talented chefs that live in town here, that work and have businesses in town here, restaurants, let them make a different version of salmon dish or a halibut dish. So that's what it grew into. That's what's happened at the Jack the last couple of years. And that was so fun. because you got to just get every cuisine and have it be so beautifully made.
Yeah.
Yeah, so
and
now we've even increased the number of restaurants.
Yeah,
right?
It's gone from 6 to 8. Give you a quick rundown
sure.
of everyone participating this year. We have Abby's Kitchen, Breeze Inn, The Rookery, Saffron, Salt, Suwana Thai Cafe, TK McGuire's at the Prospector, and V's Cellar Door are all preparing seafood. Menu items have started to come in. We are looking to get those today or Monday from everyone, and we'll begin to publicize some of the dishes that folks are making next week, and I can tell you they are pretty mouthwatering.
Cool. And then live music.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've got Robert Cohen, and also we got the Burton's.
That guy.
Those guys.
That guy in the arts room.
Great
yeah,
Alaskan
we do have the
Bluegrass
Band. Bluegrass Band.
Which is going to be super fun. They're always great. And Robert Cohen, he's awesome. It's a Robert Cohen trio playing, is that right? Okay.
Yep. Yeah.
So that's
going to
be fun. Kind of happening throughout the night. The music kind of just happening throughout the night. Is that the idea?
Yeah. Well, the event itself is from 6 to 9. That's the general admission ticket. And then from 5 to 6... we will be partnering with the Alaskan Brewing Company for the tutored tasting. So that piece is back again this year. And then the live music will start up at 6 as the doors open to general admission. And we will have we'll spend that first hour with Rob Cohen. And then from 7 to 9, we'll pick it up a bit with Great Alaska Bluegrass Band. We're going to have a dance floor down in Centennial Hall. So we're really pulling out all the stops this year.
It's going to be awesome.
I can't wait.
Yeah.
I'm really excited. We also we have a silent auction as a part of this event, too. So there's going to be plenty to keep everyone busy throughout the evening.
That's going to be a blast. So it's so fun, like you said, to think about it. It used to be just like kind of getting all this halibut together and all the staff here. And now it's just grown into this thing and hundreds of more people are coming and able to have a great time. So are there tickets available ahead of time, things like that, or how do people get that sort of lined
There are
up?
Indeed. And in fact, they're selling really
briskly. Yes.
Yeah. we've sold the first 100, so a third of them are gone already. You can get them at ktoo.org. Look along the side. You'll see the little button there on the side. Click on that. It'll bring you right to the ticket site. Or you can also come into the station during business hours, pick one up in person.
All right. Justin, thanks so much for coming in. Justin Showman with KTOO, and that's the Seafood Fest. It's all happening February 6th over at Centennial Hall, and you can get tickets online, as Justin just said, at ktoo.org. Justin, thanks.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. And that's it for Juno Afternoon today. As I shoo the KTOO employees out of the studio here, thanks so much to all the folks who came in today, including Justin Showman, Mercedes Munoz, also Brandon Howard. We had Julie Diana in here, and then Wayne Jensen. All those people are busy making Juno a really fun place to live at these times when we've got all kinds of great events happening. So great to hear about all that stuff. Got Sound and Motion happening tonight, too. I'll be out at the brewery tonight from 5 to 7. Go meet me out there and have some big beers and barley wines if you're interested. Rain is diminishing this afternoon as we speak, and tonight there's a slight chance of rain in the evening, and then rain late. And rain is a common theme throughout the rest of the forecast, so that's all you really need to know, is it's going to be raining and not too cold in the 40s or so. That's it for Juno Afternoon today. I'm Andy Klein. Thanks so much for joining me, and have a great weekend.
This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas. We also rebroadcast on translators K276AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay, K269AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creeks, K210AM in Gustavus, K220BT in Hoonah, and K210AS in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. In Juneau, KTOO is on GCI Cable on digital channel 871. We're also online at ktoo.org. Support for national programming on KTOO comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
We have had enough of establishment politics, establishment economics. We need to move in a new and bold direction.
Campaign attacks in Iowa get more pointed and personal. It's Friday, January 22nd, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro. This hour, we'll hear about the lives of Syrians living under siege in freezing temperatures.
It's surprising, though, they don't have food, but some of them have access to the internet.
Also, children's books wrestle with slavery. And say goodbye to the old SAT, a new version is on its way.
We would ask students the definitions of words that perhaps they crammed for the night before the test, but may not use.
Later, the X-Files returns. We'll hear from the composer of that classic creepy theme music, plus a surprising connection between Donald Trump and Woody Guthrie. That's coming up after this news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. At least five people are dead, two injured in a shooting at an Aboriginal community school in northern Saskatchewan. That's in Canada. The grade 7 through 12 school is in the community of Laloche, and the acting mayor of the town says the shooter is in custody. The major storm hitting the East Coast at this hour is responsible for at least eight deaths across three states. That's according to the Associated Press. Some cities could see well over 2 feet by the time the storm ends on Sunday. Blizzard warnings are up along the I-95 corridor in the Mid-Atlantic. Thousands are without power in several areas. In Washington, D.C., gale force winds gusting to 50 miles an hour are expected to create blinding conditions and high snow drifts. Muriel Bowser is the city's mayor.
The snow is coming down wet and heavy, which means that we could see trees in power lines down and a loss of power.
Coastal flooding is also a worry from Delaware up through New Jersey. In a closely watched case today, the Kansas Court of Appeals struck down the state's ban on the second trimester abortion method known as dilation and evacuation. Dan Margolis of member station KCUR has more.
The ruling is a major victory for abortion rights activists who argue the ban increased the complexity and risk of second trimester abortions, and it marks the first time a Kansas appellate court based the right to abortion in the Kansas Constitution. Kansas was the first state to ban the procedure, termed by opponents dismemberment abortion. In a statement, Kansas Governor Sam Brownback deplored the ruling and said it underscored the importance of every judge, quote, upholding the right to life. The state plans to appeal to the Kansas Supreme Court. For NPR News, I'm Dan Margolis in Kansas City.
Federal regulators are temporarily barring health insurer Cigna from selling new policies to Medicare recipients. NPR's Allison Kojak reports the company's being sanctioned because of problems resolving customer complaints.
The Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services told Cigna it can no longer market its Medicare Advantage insurance and Part D drug plans to new customers. The letter from CMS says Cigna's conduct is, quote, a serious threat to the health and safety of Medicare beneficiaries. They say Cigna customers have trouble accessing medical services and getting medications. Cigna said in a statement it was suspended because of problems dealing with grievances and appeals. The company said the problems are, quote, unacceptable, and that it has already begun working to fix them. Cigna in July struck a deal to sell itself to rival Anthem. If that deal goes through, the combined companies will become the largest health insurer in the U.S. Allison Kojak, NPR News, Washington.
Wall Street higher by the closing bell, the Dow up 210 points. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Fox, presenting The X-Files Return to Fox this Sunday with a six-episode event from series creator Chris Carter and starring David Duchovny and Gillian Anderson, Sunday after the NFC Championship game on Fox.
Good afternoon. You're listening to All Things Considered on KTOO. I'm Dominique Johnson with this local news update. Governor Bill Walker called for the entire legislature to work together with him to close the state's budget shortfall. The annual State of the State address last night reflected Alaska's grave budget situation. Walker said the budget crisis was a long time coming. He said the state has had a hole in what he called its fiscal boat since oil production began to drop in the 1980s.
As governor, I am flexible on the details of a fiscal plan, as long as the outcome meets the basic tests of fairness and sustainability. I am not flexible on the need to get there this year. It's time to fix the hole in the boat.
Walker said he was warned some of his proposals would hasten the end of his political career. He said he was putting the state's interest above his own. Senator John Coghill said fellow Republicans agreed with much of what Walker said, but his party is looking for deeper spending cuts. And Coghill suggested that while there may be progress, the legislature is unlikely to close the entire shortfall this year.
Some of the details that he has put forward are going to be tougher to shuffle together than alluded to in the speech.
The speech came near the end of the first week of the legislative session. Last year, the legislature ran well past their 90-day deadline to adopt a budget. A bill that would update Alaska's military code of justice and strengthen penalties for certain violations has advanced from the House Judiciary Committee. The bill would update a code that has been largely unused by the Alaska National Guard. The Guard has not used it to court-martial a service member since 1955. Progress on the bill comes more than a year after the National Guard Bureau found that the Guard had not been properly investigating or adjudicating Guard member misconduct cases and did not have a process for coordinating with local law enforcement in Guard member misconduct cases. Proposed updates to the code include changes in what criminal behavior is subject to court-martial proceedings. And tonight's forecast calls for scattered rain showers, then rain developing late with lows around 36 degrees, southeast winds around 10 to 15 miles per hour. All Things Considered continues on KTOO. We're online at ktoo.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro. The race for the presidency is more intense than it has ever been. Polls are getting tighter. Attacks are getting sharper. Iowa caucus is in just over a week. To discuss the state of play, David Brooks of the New York Times is with us, as is E.J. Dionne of the Washington Post and the Brookings Institution. Good to have you both here.
Great to be here.
Let's start with the attacks between the two leading Democrats, Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. We have a clip from each of them on the campaign trail this week.
Now, in theory, there's a lot to like about some of his ideas, but in theory isn't enough. A president has to deliver in reality.
We have had enough of establishment politics, establishment economics. We need to move in a new and bold direction.
David, is this 2008 all over again when Barack Obama came from behind to defeat Hillary Clinton?
It actually feels a little like that to me. This is not a great year for pragmatism and for incrementalism. And Hillary has positioned herself as a pragmatic incrementalist. I agree with that philosophically, but this is a year where the electorate wants some sort of transformational tectonic shift.
EJ, do you think that's right, that Clinton is just not the candidate for the electorate this year, or is there something she did wrong that she could have done differently?
Well, see, what I think is that there's an Obama paradox here, which is if you look at the polls in Iowa, 91% of Iowa Democrats, likely caucus voters, like Barack Obama. But there is also this frustration in the Democratic Party that Democrats, including Obama, have been on the defensive. And there is something liberating about the Bernie Sanders rhetoric, and that you see this kind of catharsis in that remarkable ad that Bernie Sanders made, where no words are spoken, but the great Simon and Garfunkel song America plays, and it does create a sense of a movement. In that sense, Bernie Sanders' campaign is akin to Obama's. But I think something else needs to be said, which is from the beginning, and as David knows, I thought this last fall, I've always thought Bernie Sanders was well set up to win Iowa and New Hampshire, because those are good electorates for him. And the question will be, does this carry forward? But Bernie has run a very good campaign that captures a certain mood inside the Democratic Party.
What is it about the electorate in Iowa and New Hampshire that's particularly good for Sanders?
Well, it's primarily overwhelmingly white, very liberal generally in the case of Iowa caucus goers. And in New Hampshire, it's right next door to Vermont. Bernie is a well-known figure. So these are good states for him. That doesn't take away from the fact that he's run a really good campaign.
Let's turn to the Republicans now, where the race in Iowa at least seems to be coming down to Ted Cruz versus Donald Trump. And we have a clip of each of them, starting with Trump.
See, they're not real tough guys. They're phony tough guys. They're trying to get votes, and after they get in, they're politicians. All talk, no action politicians. It's not going to work. Not going to work.
We need to take power out of Washington and back to we the people.
That is what this campaign is all about.
David, at this point, the establishment seems to be at war over which of these two men is the lesser of two evils.
It's sort of a war between ideology and chaos.
Which is which?
If you're a philosophical conservative, if you work at National Review, or if you work at the Wall Street Journal editorial page, you like, of the two, if you're forced to choose between the two, you like Cruz. He's more consistent ideologically. He's more consistent philosophically. If you're a rogue Republican like Sarah Palin, you like Donald Trump because he's rogue, and ideologically he's all over the map.
Although Terry Branstad, the governor of Iowa, who is considered an establishment Republican, disavowed Cruz this week.
Yeah, I think that was local politics. That was about ethanol. So I happen to think this is a year, and I think this is an effect which the Republican establishment has not appreciated, that the last 10 years have made the Republican electorate less conservative, or at least less anti-government. They're willing to have a government, so long as it's not filled with liberal cultural values, that's on the side of the little guy. And Donald Trump has tapped into that.
EJ, the National Review wrote a really scathing editorial against Donald Trump, and the RNC, the Republican National Committee, actually pulled the National Review from a debate that they were supposed to be a part of because of this.
Well, I'm not surprised, because they clearly chose, in a principled way, one could say, to take a stand in the presidential election. So the idea would have been that they're supposed to be neutral. But I think what's fascinating here is that within the Republican Party, you've got splits within splits within splits. You've got the aggressive right end of the party divided between the ideologues. One could say Cruz's chaotic ideology. And on the other